Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we are reading from the April 11th, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week has a smiling Donald Trump. He is, in this scene, a used car salesman. He's wearing a plaid coat. He's got an extra wavy hair. Behind him is one of those air-blown stick men with the wavy arms waving around. He's showing a white little SUV that's been marked up from about $21,800 to $27,250. There's a big banner in the background saying, special offer, pay 25% more, and you'll love it. The headline is, Driving Up Prices, How Trump's Tariff Offensive Could Backfire on Americans. That's our first main story. We'll start there. Trump imposes sweeping global tariffs. What happened? Declaring Liberation Day from decades of free trade policies that have allowed the U.S. to be plundered by other nations, President Trump this week upended the global trading system by imposing sweeping tariffs on every U.S. trading partner. Trump placed a 10% blanket tariff on all imports and additional import taxes on dozens of, quote, bad actors he accused of unfair trading practices. They include an extra 24% import tax on China. The country's total rate will be 54%, including previously announced tariffs, 36% on Vietnam, 14% on Japan, and 10% on the European Union. Americans have been ripped off for more than 50 years, Trump said, but it is not going to happen anymore. He said tariffs would generate trillions and trillions of dollars, and that with import barriers in place, jobs and factories will come roaring back into our country. The announcement followed a round of previous tariffs that include 25% on goods from Mexico and Canada, which were spared additional tariffs, 25% global tariffs on steel and aluminum, and a 25% tariff on imported cars and car parts. Foreign leaders vowed to hit back with countermeasures on American products and services, and economists warned that the tariffs will raise prices on everything from homes to electronics and groceries. In anticipation of the tariffs, Goldman Sachs put 35% odds on a near-term recession, up from a previous estimate of 20%. This is a prelude to Act One of a global trade war, said economist Sebnem Kalemli-Ozcan. Then I think we will see the reality is as not America first, but America alone. What the editorial said. Trump will liberate Americans, all right, said the Philadelphia Inquirer, from low prices and a bullish stock market. He thinks tariffs are a magic bullet, but history shows the free trade of post-war era has led to an unprecedented economic growth. Trump's first-term tariffs cost the U.S. 300,000 jobs, and his new much larger levies will impose far more pain. Goldman Sachs warns that the S&P 500 could sink 5% over the next 3 months. Consumer confidence is at a 12-year low, and the U.S. economy, the envy of the world, just months ago, may now be headed toward recession. It all adds up to kamikaze economics. Trump trade advisor Peter Navarro claims the tariffs will yield $6 trillion in revenue over a decade, said the Wall Street Journal. By any definition, that's a tax increase of historic proportions, and it will be paid by consumers when importers pass on tariffs in the form of higher prices. Trump believes short-term pain will give way to long-term economic glory But it's clear his ideological fixation on tariffs is crowding out rational judgment. We'll see what his blue-collar voters think when they're whacked by price spikes and shrinking retirement accounts. What the columnist said. Trump is right, said John Michelson in the Wall Street Journal. The global trading regime must change. Opening U.S. markets to the world made sense after World War II, when Europe and Japan were rebuilding and we were running major trade surpluses. But we now run big deficits, and the flood of imports has cost millions of American jobs and devastated the industrial heartland. By upending the status quo, Trump will rebuild American industry and bring manufacturing jobs back to regions now better known for opioid abuse than humming factories. That's a pipe dream, said Stephen Greenhouse in The Guardian. If you want companies to invest in domestic manufacturing, you need to give them economic and political stability. But no CEO will spend $200 million to build a factory based on tariffs that might be lifted tomorrow when a foreign leader flatters Trump. Meanwhile, existing factories are already being hammered by tariffs and counter-tariffs that are sabotaging supply chains and raising the cost of vital raw materials like steel and aluminum. Trump is upending the global economy based on a theory that makes no sense, said Jason Furman in the New York Times. He insists trade deficits mean the U.S. is getting ripped off, but that's deluded. Tariff rates generally have little bearing on trade deficits, and imports are good, not bad. They lower prices, offer consumers greater variety. Think Mexican avocados and South Korean cars, and benefit U.S. manufacturers by giving them access to lower-cost parts and materials that let them be globally competitive. Trump can't fix a non-existent problem, but he can usher in inflation, job losses, and a tax increase on American families. Controversy of the week, free speech. The case of Rumeysa Öztürk. Welcome to Trump's America, said Jonah Valdez in The Intercept, where you can be disappeared for writing an op-ed. If you haven't yet seen the chilling surveillance camera footage, Rumeysa Öztürk, 30, a Turkish Fulbright scholar at Tufts University, was walking to meet friends last week when masked federal agents seized her on a street in Somerville, Massachusetts, and whisked her away in an unmarked SUV. For nearly a day, no one knew where Öztürk was until she surfaced at an Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility in Louisiana. She is now awaiting deportation for activities in support of Hamas, according to the Department of Homeland Security, or as Secretary of State Marco Rubio told reporters, for creating a ruckus. Both allegations sound like references to last year's campus protest against Israel's war in Gaza, said Zach Bocamp in Vox. Rubio says he's revoked the visas of more than 300 students so far. But unlike, say, Mahmoud Khalil, the green card-holding Columbia protest organizer arrested last month, the extent of Öztürk's ruckus appears to be an op-ed she co-authored in the Tufts Daily that calls on the university to divest from Israel. It says nothing that even approximates support for Hamas. State agents, in other words, abducted a legal migrant for expressing a political opinion, an attack on civil liberties that we would not hesitate to label as authoritarian in another country. Öztürk wasn't kidnapped or disappeared, said Rich Lowry in National Review. She was simply arrested. Yes, the ICE officers wore masks, a prudent measure given the doxing habits of the online left, but the agents treated Öztürk with respect and even kindness, one of them telling her, "I understand it's scary," and no doubt it was. Some unpleasantness is inherent in any arrest, And unlike those grabbed off the streets of banana republics, Özturk now gets a formal court hearing with ample legal representation and nothing to lose but her student visa. When the worst case scenario is being free to go home to live your life however you please, these lurid comparisons to third world torture regimes are grotesque and unfair. Her punishment isn't the issue, said Jeffrey Blahar in National Review. Yes, the Secretary of State has broad discretion to remove non-citizens from the U.S., but using that power to capriciously expel someone for expressing an unpopular opinion is utterly abhorrent and should be to all conservatives who claim to revere free speech. It sounds like there could be more evidence against Özturk, said the Free Press in an editorial. Speaking to reporters, Rubio seemed to dismiss the idea that he'd revoke someone's visa just because you want to write op-eds. But if Özturk did more than that, what was it? The administration's emerging pattern of detaining people for alleged crimes but not providing evidence risk eroding public trust in the rule of law. What if that's the goal, said Ayman Ismail in Slate. Week after week, arrest after arrest, the Trump administration is pushing the limits of the law and widening the circle of people with reason to fear persecution by the state for unspecified acts of speech or disloyalty. With the brazen state abduction of Özturk, that circle now includes all foreign nationals, especially Muslims. Before long, it could be any of us. No one is safe, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Stunning and unprecedented things are happening in Trump's America in broad daylight on our formerly free sidewalks. The only consolation in Özturk's shocking arrest is that we can finally stop talking about the threat of creeping authoritarianism because tyranny is already here. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for active seniors. After President Trump told NBC News that he is not joking about running for a third term in 2028, although the U.S. Constitution limits presidents to two terms in office, Trump, who will be 82 in November 2028, said there are methods. It was a good week for lovers. After Virginia was named the U.S. state best prepared to withstand an invasion by space aliens, among other factors in Virginia's resilience, researchers cited the state's dense forest coverage and third in the nation prevalence of military personnel. And it was a good week for diversity and inclusion. After the University of Maryland announced that Kermit the Frog, a puppet, will deliver its 2025 commencement address. Kermit's creator, the late Jim Henson, attended the university. UM President Daryl J. Pines said he was thrilled that graduating seniors will experience the optimism and insight of the plush amphibian. But it was a bad week for transubstantiation. After red spots discovered on a communion wafer at a Catholic church in Indiana were identified through biochemical analysis as a fungus and three different species of bacteria, rather than, as initially rumored, the blood of Jesus Christ. It was a bad week for hard stares after two engineers with Britain's Royal Air Force pleaded guilty to destroying a fiberglass statue of Paddington Bear after a night of drinking. Sentencing the pair to community service, Judge Sam Guzzi told the servicemen that their actions were the antithesis of everything Paddington stands for. And it was a bad week for gourmands after Canadian tax officials included manatee meat on a list of U.S. products to be targeted with tariffs. Economist Jason Chow said the meat was likely listed as padding and doubts the price hike will create too much of a backlash from Canadian customers. And in other news, Pentagon mandates sex-neutral fitness standards for military. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth this week ordered the Pentagon to eliminate lower physical fitness requirements for women in combat units likely to see significant fighting in wartime. The military conducts routine annual fitness tests with the requirements varying based on gender and age. However, some of the most demanding roles, such as for special operations, pararescue jumpers, infantry, and armor, already have standardized physical fitness requirements that don't take gender or age into consideration. More than 5,000 women serve in the U.S. military in combat roles. Hegseth has long complained about the military's fitness standards and openly opposed women in combat jobs. The military has tried in the past to develop a general fitness test that was gender and age neutral, but scrapped the effort in 2022 after women and older soldiers had difficulty passing. The story on the briefing page this week is Fighting Against Fluoride. A growing number of communities are ending water fluoridation. Will public health suffer? Why do we add fluoride to water? Because it helps keep teeth strong, replacing minerals that are lost during regular wear and tear. Grand Rapids, Michigan became the first city in the world to add fluoride to its public water in 1945. Within 11 years, the amount of tooth damage from decay among the city's children had dropped by 60%. About 72% of Americans served by public water systems now drink fluoridated water, and the process is estimated to save about $6.5 billion in dental costs annually. Fluoride is the perfect example of helping people without them even having to do anything, said Dr. Srinivas Koka, former dean of the University of Mississippi Medical Center's School of Dentistry. But an anti-fluoride movement has been gaining steam in recent years, with more than 170 communities across the U.S. rejecting fluoridated water since 2010 over health fears. In Florida alone, at least 24 cities and counties have ended fluoridation since September. Last week, Utah became the first state to ban the addition of the mineral to public water, with Republican Governor Spencer Cox claiming there isn't sufficient evidence to require people to be medicated by their government. Is fluoride dangerous? Too much fluoride, a naturally occurring mineral in soil, water, and rocks, can be a bad thing, causing skeletal fluorosis. But to develop that extremely rare bone-weakening condition, you'd need to consume more than 30 times the fluoride normally found in fluoridated water. Without clear scientific evidence of harms, opposition to fluoridation was long rooted in conspiracy theories. In the 1960s, the far-right John Birch Society claimed fluoridation was a communist mind-control plot. The anti-fluoride campaign moved from the political fringe to the mainstream amid the pandemic, part of a wider backlash against public health measures. In the days before the 2024 election, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., an anti-vax activist who is now health secretary, called the mineral an industrial waste and vowed the incoming Trump administration would recommend its removal from public water systems. The movement has been further supercharged by recent research suggesting risks to children from higher levels of fluoride. What does that research say? A study in May found that women who had higher levels of fluoride in their urine during pregnancy were more likely to report that their children went on to experience temper tantrums, suffer anxiety, and complain of headaches and stomach aches. "Our results do give me pause," said study author Tracy Bastain of the University of Southern California. "Pregnant individuals should probably be drinking filtered water. what some scientists call the study flawed, noting it involved a single sample of 229 women and relied on a single urine sample taken once during pregnancy, which is not sufficient to prove true fluoride overexposure. A few months later, a report from the Federal National Toxicology Program, the combined data from 74 studies, concluded with moderate confidence that higher fluoride exposures are consistently associated with lower IQ in children. The report didn't quantify the exact effects, but some of the studies showed a drop of a few IQ points with an exposure above 1.5 milligrams of fluoride per liter of water. While that might seem like a bombshell finding, many researchers say the paper should not worry Americans who drink fluoridated water. Why not? Critics note that more than two-thirds of the studies examined were deemed by the report's authors to have a high risk of bias, undermining their reliability. More importantly, most of the data dealt with exposure levels far above those common in the U.S., where the Department of Health and Human Services recommends 0.7 milligrams of fluoride per liter, equivalent to about three drops of fluoride in a 55-gallon barrel. Only seven of the studies looked at children whose drinking water was below 1.5 milligrams per liter. In those studies, there was no relationship between IQ and fluoride. The science is not as strong as it's presented by the authors, said Stephen Levy, a dental public health expert at the University of Iowa. Despite these problems, the report's contents were given substantial weight in a September ruling from a federal court ordering the Environmental Protection Agency to address potential risks from fluoridation to infants. Are there alternatives to fluoridating water? Critics say the wide availability of fluoride toothpaste and mouthwash means there's no need to add the mineral to public water systems. But the Centers for Disease Control argues that a combination of fluoridated water and dental products containing fluoride provides the greatest protection against tooth decay. And fluoride advocates say dental products aren't accessible to everyone, especially low-income Americans. Many kids tell us they don't even have their own toothbrush, said Dr. Scott Tamar of the University of Illinois Chicago, who runs school-based dental programs. What happens without fluoride? Dentists warn that ending water fluoridation will lead to a decline in America's dental health. That's exactly what happened in Buffalo after the city quietly stopped adding fluoride in 2015 while upgrading equipment at a water treatment facility. Few residents knew about the change until a local newspaper reported on it in 2023. Local dentists said it explained why they had seen a sharp rise in cavities among the city's children in recent years. What always gets me, said Jennifer Meyer, a nurse and professor of health sciences at the University of Alaska, is that the anti-fluoride activists aren't at the bedside while that kid is getting a procedure to deal with an extensive tooth decay or an extraction or a full mouth reconstruction in the operating room. But healthcare, public health, dental professionals are. Moving on to the best columns, we'll take the first two come from the U.S., starting with nearing a showdown with Iran. President Trump isn't playing around with Iran, said Noah Rothman. He has given Tehran 2 months to agree to a deal that will end the Iranian nuclear weapons program, or, he said last week, there will be bombing. As a natural isolationist, Trump would prefer a peaceful settlement. But a methodical buildup of American forces in Iran's neighborhood suggests he's deadly serious about the military option. Last week, the USS Carl Vinson aircraft carrier was sent to join the USS Harry S. Truman carrier in the Middle East. and up to seven B-2 stealth bombers have been deployed to a base in the Indian Ocean that's been used to stage strikes in the region. B-2s are among the only aircraft used to stage strikes in the region. B-2s are among the only aircraft capable of carrying the 30,000-pound bunker busters that would be needed to hit Iran's underground nuclear facilities. Iran's ability to retaliate against a U.S. strike would be limited. Israel has destroyed Tehran's proxies in Gaza and Lebanon. Its ally in Syria has collapsed. Anger is rising at home. Both Trump and the mullahs know the Islamic Republic is more vulnerable than it has been in decades. One way or another, the Iranian nuclear issue is building toward a dramatic resolution. How tyranny can coexist with normalcy. We are witnessing the birth of a dual state, said Aziz Hook. Through its radical reinterpretation of federal law and appointment of officials more loyal to MAGA than the Constitution, the Trump administration is cleaving off a domain in which the law does not apply. Migrants are deprived of due process and shipped to foreign prisons, while January 6 rioters are given pardons and praise. Ordinary spending responsibilities become tools to punish foes, while allies are rewarded with generous government contracts. It's worth remembering that the Nazis began with a two-track system, a capitalist economy governed by stable laws for most Germans, and a domain of lawlessness and state violence for Jews and other supposed internal enemies. Of course, a dual state need not end in genocide. Look at Vladimir Putin's Russia. And it need not spark mass opposition, since the lawless domain may not touch the lives of most citizens, who can turn away while dissidents and scapegoats lose their political liberty. That doesn't mean favored citizens are safe. History shows that once the lawless state is built, it can swallow anyone. This is one of the international columns. Gaza, protesters tell Hamas, its time is up. Trapped in a losing war, Palestinians are finally turning on Hamas, said Akram Atala. Rare spontaneous demonstrations erupted in Gaza last week after the Israel-Hamas ceasefire collapsed and Israel renewed its attacks, telling Gazans who had just returned to their destroyed neighborhoods to evacuate again. The protests started when families gathered in Beit Lahia, a farming community in northern Gaza, to honor relatives who were killed in the war. First, a few hundred people took to the streets screaming for an end to the fighting. Before long, thousands of angry civilians were chanting, "Hamas out, and we want to live." Caught between Israel's military and Hamas feared armed wing, the people have no choice and nothing left to lose. They are hungry, broken, sad, with no end in sight on this long nightmare. Hamas can hardly be surprised they're fed up. It has ruled since 2007 and brought only war, liberating nobody but leaving Gaza in ruins. The descent offers a rare sign of hope, said Navav Eyal. The videos of Palestinians demanding the release of Hamas's remaining Israeli hostages obliterate the arguments of Israeli hawks that there are no innocents in Gaza, that the enclave's 2 million people all bear responsibility for Hamas' massacre of 1,200 Israelis on October 7, 2023. Israeli intelligence has found that Hamas falsified polls to hide considerable criticism of its rule during the war and before it. Yes, there are bloodthirsty fundamentalists in Gaza, but there are also ordinary people pleading for a future for their children, yearning for normalcy and freedom. There's no denying that many Gazans have been radicalized, said Haim Leiter. But civilians are still the only ones who can change their toxic culture. That's why it's crucial for Israel to support this uprising. For months, Israel's critics have drunk Hamas Kool-Aid and branded us as the aggressor, the cause of the conflict. Now is our chance to demonstrate to the world that our goal has never been to eradicate our neighbors, but to uproot the terrorist at our gates. We Palestinians can't defend our homeland without being demonized and branded as extremist and terrorist, said Ahmad Yusuf. But we are terrorism's greatest victims. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has never been a partner for peace. He exploited the rift between the West Bank-based Palestinian Authority and Gaza-based Hamas to torpedo the peace process. October 7th was a huge mistake that would not have happened if Palestinians had been united behind the goal of establishing our own state. Israel's renewed offensive was a crushing blow to everyone in Gaza, except for Hamas, said Gazan lawyer and activist Mumin al-Natur. It sees a resumed war as a chance to further entrench itself. This is a make-or-break moment. With nothing left to lose, many of us Gazans are using what little power we have to take a stand against the group that has dictated every aspect of our lives for 18 years. We want to live. That means Hamas must go. The hostages taken from Israel must be released, and this war must then finally come to an end. The last word, our feature article. Interesting topic today. The quest to reverse aging. Breakthroughs in cellular reprogramming give scientists hope that cells could be made young again, said Gretchen Reynolds in the Washington Post. Now the technique is nearing human trials. For those hoping to cure death, and they are legion, a 2016 experiment at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies in San Diego has become liminal, the moment that changed everything. The experiment involved mice born to live fast and die young, bred with a rodent version of progeria, a condition that causes premature aging. Left alone, the animals grow gray and frail and then die about 7 months later, compared with a lifespan of about 2 years for typical lab mice. But the Salk scientists had a plan to change the aging animals' fate. They injected them with a virus carrying 4 genes that can reshape DNA and, in effect, make every cell in the rodents' bodies young again. The scientists could even control the genes from outside the mice, turning them on and off to manage the safety and potency of the genetic changes. The experiment worked. The animals lived 30% longer afterward, a marked improvement, if not quite a normal mouse lifespan. And with that, the longevity gold rush entered a new era. Tech titans and venture capitalists started throwing billions of dollars at labs exploring the technique called cellular reprogramming. Experiments began on other mice as well as worms and monkeys. Cellular reprogramming is now hailed by its supporters as the most promising scientific approach to improving human health spans and lifespans. Proponents claim it has the potential to reshape how and whether we grow old. And later this year, a biotech company called Life Biosciences expects to file an application with the Food and Drug Administration to get approval for the first human trial of a version of the technique, according to Sharon Rosenzweig Lipson, the company's chief scientific officer. But there have been some serious side effects during some of the animal experiments, including gruesome tumors and even deaths. Some researchers worry the science is moving too fast, and basic questions about cellular reprogramming safety and effects for people in society still need to be addressed. What are the long-term health consequences? Who will benefit most? Wealthy donors or anyone who's aging or chronically ill? How much will it cost? And how far are humans willing to go for the possibility of more life? Honestly, said Lucy Zhu, a postdoctoral research fellow at Harvard Medical School who's studied reprogramming in mice, those questions keep me awake at night. If you've never heard of cellular reprogramming, you're hardly alone. A relatively new field, it began with a jaw-dropping 2006 revelation that just four genes could return even the oldest, most decrepit cell to a state resembling youth. Those genes and their effects were discovered by the Japanese scientist Shinya Yamanaka, who won the Nobel Prize in 2012 for his work and had the genes named after him. They became known as Yamanaka factors. When introduced into a cell, the Yamanaka factors rapidly strip it of the outer layer of its DNA, known as the epigenome. Our epigenome is the key to cellular reprogramming and also, frankly, life itself. If you've ever wondered how the cells in your heart know to be heart cells and not skin, bowel, or some other cells, you can thank your epigenome. It's what gives every cell its identity. DNA starts out alike in almost every cell, but almost immediately, tiny clumps of molecules known as methyl groups start attaching themselves like molecules to the outside of various genes, with different configurations in different cells. Depending on the number and pattern of these molecules, the genes beneath will be able to receive biochemical signals telling them to turn on or they won't. This process, called methylation, is probably the most important part of our epigenome. Methylation continues throughout our lives and reflects those lives for better or worse. Smoking strongly influences methylation patterns. So does exercise, although in almost opposite fashion. Ditto for stress, nutrition, parenting, illness, air pollution, and many other choices and conditions. Through methylation, our epigenome functions, in effect, as our body's diary, with the tiny molecular doodles on our DNA recording what we've been doing with ourselves. But nothing affects methylation as much as aging. The patterns of methylation during infancy are distinctly different than during childhood, adulthood, and old age. Many longevity researchers believe these changes in methylation don't just record our aging process, they drive it, meaning our evolving epigenome may be responsible for aging itself. In petri dishes, cellular reprogramming works just as expected. Add the Yamanaka factors to skin cells from wrinkled centenarian, as scientists have done, and many of the cells will shed their methyl marks and turn back into newborn cells, or what scientists called pluripotent stem cells. With no cellular memory of having been skin, these cells can become almost any type of cell, with the right coaxing. Pluripotent stem cells from donated human cells are routinely used today for tissue engineering and other medical and research purposes. But the process isn't efficient, or benign. In a dish containing millions of elderly cells, many will become youthful stem cells after exposure to Yamanaka factors, but many others won't, for reasons that remain mysterious. Some resist the process, some die, and some, almost invariably, transform into huge, rapidly dividing growths known as teratomas, or monster tumors. These develop when a stem cell doesn't know what to become and turns into the wrong kind of cell. With a teratoma, teeth cells can wind up growing in a pelvic or bone cells in an eyeball. Although rarely malignant, teratomas often swell to massive sizes. Researchers can eliminate teratomas in petri dishes easily enough, but in living creatures, the growths create real-life horror films. when Spanish researchers activated Yamanaka factors in healthy mice for an early cellular reprogramming experiment, many of the animals died within weeks, sprouting teratomas and other cancerous tumors all over their bodies. You'll always have teratomas during cellular reprogramming, said Paul Knopfler, a professor at the University of California, Davis, who studies epigenetics, stem cells, and cancer. It's part of the process. It's actually how you can tell reprogramming is working. So, to realize the promise of reprogramming in people, researchers realized they would need to find a better, safer way to turn back cellular time. Several years ago, at a laboratory at Harvard University, scientists compressed the optic nerves of otherwise healthy mice to induce a condition similar to a stroke in the eye. This condition can substantially reduce vision. The scientists then treated the mice with an innovative new form of cellular reprogramming, injecting their eyes with a virus carrying three of the Yamanaka factors, omitting one factor that has been found to often jumpstart cancers. The three remaining factors were genetically engineered to grow active only in the presence of the antibiotic doxycycline. The scientists then gave the mice water containing the antibiotic on a controlled schedule of 2 days with the drug and 5 days without for 2 months. The plan was to reprogram cells in the optic nerve only partially, removing much but not all of their methylation. That way, the cells would retain their fundamental identity, even as they grew functionally younger. In this scenario, teratomas wouldn't present an obstacle because the affected cells would never regress fully into stem cells. Instead, they'd be the same cells, but sprightlier, younger, and hopefully more capable of healing the injured optic nerve. The Harvard mouse study results, published in Nature in December 2020, under the cover line, Turning Back Time, seemed positive. The researchers noted epigenetic changes in the cells and regrowth of the damaged optic nerves in many of the mice who'd received the treatment. They reported no teratomas. In 2021, Life Biosciences, a company part owned by David Sinclair, senior author of the mouse eye study, licensed the Harvard Lab's version of partial cellular reprogramming. In April 2023, the company reported at an ophthalmology conference that it had successfully used this version of partial cellular reprogramming in the eyes of monkeys with a type of optic nerve stroke. The company said the experiment restored aspects of the monkeys' lost vision and altered some of the nerve cells' epigenomes, meaning the cells resembled those of younger animals. In December 2023, the company representatives met with FDA officials to discuss their plans to use partial cellular reprogramming in the eyes of people with optic nerve strokes, Rosenzweig Lipson said. Optic nerve strokes are relatively uncommon in people, typically affecting about 6,000 adults a year, but can be debilitating. If the FDA approves its application, the company will repeat the methods from the mouse and monkey experiments. Scientists will inject volunteers' eyes with Yamanaka factors that can be turned off or on with the antibiotic doxycycline. The hope is that the cells in people's damaged optic nerves will grow more youthful at an epigenetic level, and their vision will improve. Other scientists are also racing to be first to influence aging in people. The rewards, medical, societal, and financial, could be enormous. By the time of the Harvard study, different forms of partial cellular programming were already in use at a number of labs. Reputedly the best-funded biotech startup company in history, Altos Labs opened in January 2022 with about $3 billion in seed funding from tech billionaires and others, including reportedly Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon. Headlines and commentary at the time described the lab's founding as a high-tech quest for prolonging lifespans and even immortality by reversing aging inside every cell in the body. But to start, almost all researchers and analysts agree human experiments using cellular reprogramming will be limited in scope. They'll focus on specific diseases related to aging, such as diabetes, arthritis, optic nerve stroke, glaucoma, dementia, and others, not aging itself, since aging isn't a disease, according to the FDA, and drugs and other therapies can't be approved to treat it. Though once approved, drugs can be used off-label. It's unclear, though, whether treating damaged eyes or sore knees will satisfy wealthy funders who've been pouring billions into the hunt for longer lifespans. At the same time, some researchers worry safety concerns remain insurmountable. I don't believe there can be reprogramming, even partial reprogramming, in living people without serious side effects, says Charles Brenner, a diabetes and cancer researcher at City of Hope Research Center in Duarte, California, and frequent critic of reprogramming studies. Reprogrammed cells divide rapidly. Cancer cells divide rapidly. You're practically telling these cells to become cancer. There are other open questions, too. No one yet knows why some cells respond to reprogramming and others don't, how long the epigenetic changes last, or if reprogramming efforts should focus on specific organs or the whole body. In an ambitious study from Stanford University published in March 2024, scientists used partial reprogramming either throughout the bodies of old mice or only inside their brains, hoping in both cases to improve brain health. But the full-body experiment resulted in extra inflammation in the animals' brains for unknown reasons and few beneficial changes in neurons. The more targeted attempt with reprogramming confined to the animals' brains led to an increase in newborn neurons, but also an uptick in brain inflammation, which increases risk for neurodegeneration. I think there's potential in cellular reprogramming to combat brain diseases and other conditions, said Lucy Zhu, who led the brain study as a graduate researcher at Stanford, but has since left the field. I worry about the speed at which reprogramming researchers are moving toward human experiments, she said. Undeterred, Life Biosciences said in a statement that the company believes it remains on track to receive approval from the FDA soon and to initiate the first human clinical trials of its reprogramming therapy before the end of the year. This story originally appeared in the Washington Post. Here's one of the health and science articles, short piece. Bird flu jumps to a new livestock host. The world's first case of bird flu in sheep has been detected in the UK, adding to the long list of mammal species the disease has evolved to infect and raising fears that it could eventually become transmissible among humans. The H5N1 virus was found in a single sheep on a farm in Yorkshire, northern England, where the whole flock had to be tested after birds on the farm fell ill. The infected sheep was immediately killed, and authorities said they took strict biosecurity measures to contain the outbreak. It's not clear whether the virus can yet pass from sheep to sheep, as it does among cattle, reports the Financial Times. In many of the other mammal species affected, pigs, cats, coyotes, foxes, bears, rodents, raccoons, possums, and seals, there's some evidence such spread is happening, but it hasn't been seen in humans. Of the 70 people in the U.S. known to have been infected so far, most were dairy and poultry workers, and all apparently contracted the virus from animals. But the more species the virus evolves to infect, the higher the chance of a mutation dangerous to humans. Meera Chand, a microbiologist at the UK's Health Security Agency, says it is not yet time to panic. Current evidence suggests that the avian influenza viruses we're seeing circulating around the world do not spread easily to people, she said, and the risk of avian flu to the general public remains very low. Got time for one of the Talking Points articles. We will do Greenland sending in the advance guard. Vice President J.D. Vance went to Greenland last week to make the case for a U.S. takeover, said Clarissa Jan Lim in MSNBC.com, and was met with a frosty reception. Vance joined his wife, Usha, for a day-long visit to a U.S. military base, which came amid President Trump's calls for the U.S. to annex the self-governing Danish territory. In a press conference there, Vance said Greenlanders would fare a lot better under the United States security umbrella than under Denmark's, and admonished Denmark for underinvesting in the territory. But it was a message few seemed interested in hearing. What had been planned as a three-day trip by Usha Vance was dialed back after an uproar among local officials and residents. Greenland Prime Minister Mutabi Egidi called the visit a provocation and declined to meet with U.S. officials. But Trump only doubled down, saying, "We have to have Greenland," and refusing to rule out the use of military force. "It's a remarkable turn of events," said Walter Russell Mead in the Wall Street Journal. "For anyone who believes U.S. foreign policy should be guided by partnerships with allies, respect for international law, and due regard for ethics, Trump's threats toward a NATO ally are a political absurdity and a moral monstrosity. He risks blowing up both NATO and the framework of international laws and norms that has guided the post-war era." And for what? Trump said U.S. control of Greenland is key to national security. But Denmark has made clear it is open to the U.S. basing additional forces there. The Vance visit, which included National Security Advisor Mike Waltz and Energy Secretary Chris Wright, underscored Trump's territorial ambitions, said David E. Sanger in the New York Times. Over it hung a mystery: how far Trump is willing to go to achieve his goal. "Don't underestimate the threat here," said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. "There's a temptation to believe Trump is making chess moves and that his ulterior aim is to seek expanded access to the island or signal to NATO that limiting Russian and Chinese access to the Atlantic must be a higher priority. But over and over, we've seen that failing to take Trump at face value is a mistake. He's telling us that nothing short of annexing Greenland will do, and by now we should understand. When he says he's going to do something crazy, believe him." And we'll work through the shorter notes here. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth brought his wife to overseas meetings with foreign military counterparts where sensitive information was discussed, a highly unusual move. Attendees at such meetings typically possess security clearances. The Pentagon wouldn't say whether Jennifer Hegseth, a former Fox News producer, has one. Cuts to U.S. aid programs have resulted in more than 11,000 additional tuberculosis deaths over the past 2 months, according to the UN-affiliated Stop TB Partnership. TB infections are expected to climb 30% globally this year because of the cuts, raising the odds that a highly drug-resistant form of the disease could spread. Fewer Canadians are flying to the U.S. amid rising trade tensions. Bookings on Canada-U.S. routes from April through September are down 70% year over year, according to flight analytics from OAG. Airlines have cut more than 320,000 seats on flights between the two countries from March through October. The Oxford English Dictionary has added 42 words that originate in a foreign language and have no direct English equivalents. Among them is G-I-G-I-L, gigil, which Tagalog speakers in the Philippines use to refer to a feeling of cuteness so intense that it gives the irresistible urge to tightly clench our hands, grit our teeth, and pinch or squeeze whomever or whatever it is we find so adorable. Giggle. On the poll watch, 55% of Americans believe that President Trump has focused too much on tariffs, which 72% say will raise the cost of living in the short term, 47% in the long term. 64% say he has not paid enough attention to lowering prices. 23% think that Trump's policies are making them financially better off, down 19 percentage points from January. And we'll read two quotes from two very different people. Mark Twain in the New York Times says, "Patriotism is supporting your country all of the time and your government when it deserves it." On the other hand, Vladimir Putin, quoted in the Alabama Political Reporter, says, "There is no such thing as a former KGB agent." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, give us a call. Number is 919-832-5138. It's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.